Well, this week we have the Parsha of Balak. What I would like to do, which I don't think we've ever done, is to discuss a matter of Inyana Diyoma, and that is that within this week, and next Matzah Shabbos Sunday, will be the 17th of Tammuz, and I think it is worthwhile devoting some attention to understanding what that day is about and the period that it initiates and inaugurates, for want of a better term. But as we will see, the concerns and themes of the 17th of Tammuz might not be as far from Parshas Balak as we might think. But let us begin by considering the 17th of Tammuz itself. We know most immediately, in terms of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, that the 17th of Tammuz was the day that the walls were breached. Certainly with the second Beis HaMikdash, there's a Shaila in the Bavli and Yerushalmi, was it also the 17th of Tammuz for the first? Maybe it's a bit earlier, but we take our cue from the second Beis HaMikdash regardless, and it's the 17th of Tammuz. 3 weeks later, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, which apart from anything else, gives us some inkling, perhaps, as to the intensity of the battles that were taking place. I mean, from the walls of Yerushalayim to the Beis HaMikdash, it's something that can be traversed in a matter of minutes. And yet, somehow, the defenders of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash held out for an additional 3 weeks. Until the 9th of Av, and that is the calamity of Huvke'a Ha'ir. The city was breached. The breaching of the walls of Yerushalayim is actually, as per the Mishnah in the end of Tanis, one of five calamities that took place on the 17th of Tammuz, and we're not going to go through all of them, but I'd like to actually focus on a much earlier calamity, the first of the five, in fact, because as we'll see, that really sets the tone for a lot of what is to happen. The first of the five poronios, the five calamities that took place on the 17th of Tammuz, was the breaking of the luchos. The background to that is that immediately after Shavuos, which is the 6th of Sivan, so Moshe ascends to receive the Torah for 40 days. He's there 40 days and 40 nights. And that brings him back, depending, around about the middle of Tammuz. On the 16th of Tammuz, the people thought that he should have been back already. And it's the 16th of Tammuz that the Egel HaZahav was made. Moshe came back on the next day. By the time Moshe came back, the people were already dancing around the calf and worshipping it, and it had descended very quickly from one day to the next, from the 16th to the 17th. And therefore the 17th of Tammuz, that was the first calamity, was the breaking of the luchos as a result of the sin of the Egel HaZahav. And what we need to delicately ask, but it is an important question, is why is the breaking of the luchos looked upon as such a calamity, as such a tragedy? I mean, that's not to say that it was positive. It was obviously not good. It was obviously a trauma. But the question is, why do we consider it to be rated as a calamity? What bad came from it, if we may ask, aside from the breaking itself, which of course was not good? And the background to the question is really the answer. Because the Gemara informs us that the ramifications of the breaking of the luchos were immense. The Gemara, it's in Maseches Erevin and Daf Nun Dalet, Amud Aleph, the Gemara goes so far as to say that had the Luchos never been broken or not been broken, the Jewish people could not be subjugated by any other nation. They would have been beyond reach, beyond the control of the nations of the world, of enemy nations. Ilmale nishtabru haluchos, had the luchos not been broken, ein kol uma veloshon sholetes bahem. No other nation could have had control over the Jewish people. What is the basis in the pasuk for this idea? We know that the writing of the Aseres HaDibros was engraved on the luchos. The way that that is expressed in the pasuk is with the words charus al haluchos, charut, engraved. The Gemara engages in one of the drash mechanisms, al tikri, read not charus, ela charus. Read not engraved, read free. Free from what? Free from any oppression from the nations of the world. That now establishes the breaking of the Luchos as not only a tragedy, but almost as the root of all tragedies. Had the Luchos not been broken, none of those other tragedies could have occurred. We would have been beyond reach of enemy nations and enemy designs. But with the breaking of the Luchos, every subsequent tragedy between us and the nations of the world, exile, Churban, all of those things, now become possible. So that is the short answer as to why the breaking of the Luchos is considered to be a tragedy. But still we persist and ask, why is the breaking of the Luchos, why did it lead to all of these things? Why is so much at stake and so much changes when the Luchos are broken? I mean, again, it's infinitely better for them not to be broken, but between them being intact and broken, why does that change anything essentially about the state of the Jewish people? And the question is accentuated when we remind ourselves that it was only a matter of time before we got a new set of luchos. On Yom Kippur, we got a second set. Sounds like whatever was broken was replaced. But still we look at the breaking of the Luchos on the 17th of Tammuz as the mother of all calamities, the root of all calamities. Why is it so? At this stage, we need to ask a more prior question. And that is, in view of the fact that when we got ourselves together, we got a new set of Luchos. So when Moshe sees the Jewish people worshipping the Egel, which was a terrible, terrible fool, and clearly they're not compatible with receiving the Luchos just at the moment, why is the response to break the Luchos? If you break the Luchos, so then should they ever be deserving of Luchos, they'll need new ones. And in the end, that's what happened. But if it's possible the Jewish people could get back to themselves, so then why break the first ones? Why, if the Jewish people do not deserve to have them given to them just right now, but they might be deserving in the future, put them to the side. And if and when the time comes, they can be presented to the people. But that's not what happened. The Luchos, first point of order, are broken. If they should subsequently be deserving of Luchos, they'll need new ones, but not these ones. But why? What is behind that? Well, to answer all of these questions, we need to ask a further prior question. Because here we are talking, why is the breaking of the Luchos considered such a tragedy? Why did they need to be broken in the first place? The most basic question of all about the Luchos is not why were they broken, but why do they exist? Why are there Luchos? And to explain the background to that question, we ask, what is the role of the Luchos? What is their contribution in the whole process of receiving the Torah? As if to say, what's written on the Luchos? Let us assume what's written on the Luchos is the Aseres HaDibros. Well, the Aseret HaDibros is something that we'd already heard from Hashem. So there's no new information. There's no new content written on the Luchos. Unless you say, true, but until now, we've heard it orally. This was already a written format, and that makes a difference. Yes. However, in the fullness of time, there's much more Torah to be received, and we will receive all of that in written format. It's called a Sefer Torah. And Moshe wrote a Sefer Torah also. Which means that the Luchos seem to be in the middle, caught in the middle. They're neither here nor there. There's nothing new, so to speak, in terms of what they say. And in terms of being written down, all that and much, much more will be written down later on in the Sefer Torah. So where does that leave the Luchos? And yet, we do see that Chazal talk about the Luchos as part of the process of the giving of the Torah. They're doing something. Where do we see this? We see that the day of the giving of the Luchos is actually called a day of Matan Torah because the Luchos were given. We refer, of course, to Yom Kippur. The Mishnah says, this is also the end of Ta'anis, that Yom Kippur, one of the two happiest days of the year. The other is Tu B'Av, which we may need to discuss in a different time. But Yom Kippur, one of the happiest days of the year. What's so happy about it? Asked the Gemara. And the Gemara explains two things. Number one, we received forgiveness. That doesn't get happier than that. That's the ultimate reprieve. And number two, we receive the second set of Luchos, and the Gemara says, and that makes it a day of Matan Torah. But once again, how is it a day of Matan Torah? I mean, the Torah's already been given. The Luchos haven't been given, but we already know what's written on them. So why is the giving of the Luchos, why does it bestow upon the Yom Kippur the designation of a day of the giving of the Torah? And another final question. Because we've come back, I think, about as far as we can. But whatever the value of the Luchos is, whatever value there is of having at least a written representation of the Aseret HaDibros, even if you're going to have the whole Sefer Torah later on, why does it take the form of a different medium? The Sefer Torah is going to be written on parchment. The whole Torah will be written on parchment. Now, there's value for writing the Aseret HaDibros separately. Okay. But at the risk of asking a deconstructive question, why does it have to be on a completely different medium? Why does it have to be engraved in stone? Why not just have a smaller piece of parchment? And we're familiar with things that if you're not writing the whole Torah, so you don't need the entire Torah scroll, but you still use ink and parchment. That's what a mezuzah is. It's two paragraphs, so you have a smaller piece of parchment. In tefillin, it's four paragraphs, smaller pieces of parchment. So the fact that you're writing less doesn't change what you're writing on. But with the Luchos, it does. V'kol ze omer darsheni. What exactly is happening with the Luchos? And needless to say, there's many levels upon which the matter can be understood. But there is a medrash which I believe illuminates and really will give us our cue here. It's the Medrash HaGodol in Shemos in Parshas Kisisa. And the Medrash asks, Lama nasan lehem luchos? That's our question. Why did Hashem give them luchos? Lirmoz lehem. To allude to them. Sheyiktuvu divrei Torah al luach libam. That they should inscribe words of Torah on the tablets of their heart. Shin Emar, citing a pasuk in Mishlei, Kosveim aluach libecha. Write them on the tablet of your heart. So for the Medrash, the existence of the Luchos is to teach something about how words of Torah are meant to be received and how they're meant to be absorbed. And it's part of the giving of the Torah. because the Torah hasn't fully been given until it's been fully received. It hasn't gone from A to B unless it is now in B completely, just as it was with A. But it's not completely with the Jewish people unless and until they engrave the words of Torah on the tablet of their heart. And what does that mean? It means an absolute connection. Emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, experientially, an absolute identification. And interestingly, when the medium shifts to stone, even the writing isn't a separate entity than the stone. The writing is in the stone itself. When it comes to a klaf, a Sefer Torah, the writing is a separate entity. It's ink applied to the parchment. The letters emerge when you engrave using only the material of the tablet itself. There's no second substance that's added. It's an absolute unity. That's what the luchos are about. There's no new content coming in. But everything you know, it's about absorption. It's about connection. It's about reception. That's the final piece in the equation, which is called the giving of the Torah. To what extent is it received? And here, Maharal goes further. And Maharal states and comments that when we talk about the luchos, and it means that it should be engraved on the tablet of your heart, it's not just a message that the luchos are giving. The luchos aren't just communicating this idea. The luchos enable this idea. Meaning what the luchos embody, which is this idea of an absolute connection, engraved on the tablet of the heart, taken to heart, fully. What the luchos represent, so as the luchos themselves are given over from Hashem via Moshe to the Jewish people, when the Jewish people receive them, they receive that capacity. They receive that connection. So it's an enabling medium, not just an illuminating. It's not just to represent the idea. It's to make the idea happen, to allow the idea to happen. Had we received the luchos, and had they not been broken, that's the level of connection that we would have had. And now we can begin maybe to put more words to the picture as to what exactly we lost when the luchos were broken. When the luchos, which represent this idea, were broken before we were able to receive them, we weren't able to rise to the level or to achieve the level that they represent. Our level of connectivity with Torah was not able to be absolute in the way the luchos represent, and the way the luchos would have, as we say, enabled. And moreover, says Maharal, once you understand how much was at stake at this time, it's easy also to understand why there was such a push on the side of the forces of evil to make the Jewish people unworthy of receiving the luchos. I mean, it's almost like evil's final stand. Because once the Jewish people receive the luchos, again, they always have free will, but they're going to be operating on a much higher level. So it's almost like evil's last bid to keep the Jewish people in its clutches. And therefore, there was such an upsurge, if one can borrow in a very unholy way the words of the Pirkei Avos, Im ein achshav emosai. As far as evil is concerned, this is it. If they receive the luchos this time tomorrow, so evil is practically a thing of the past. And therefore, the Jewish people come under immense pressure. I mean, it's a capitulation that really boggles the imagination. Within one day, going from Har Sinai to worshipping the Egel. I mean, there's a lot was brought to bear there. And what exactly do we mean when we say that evil would have been, it would have been beyond reach? This brings us to a second aspect of freedom of the luchos. It's one with which I think we're more familiar because it's in Pirkei Avos. where, and it's actually the same drasha, where we say in the sixth parak, "Ein lecha ben chorin, ela misha osik b'torah." There is no one who is free except someone who learns Torah. Now we, of course, firstly need to qualify that statement. I mean, what does that mean? The freest person is a person who learns Torah. Clearly, we are not defining freedom as lack of rules. The Torah has plenty of rules. If a person learns Torah and concludes that there are no rules, they are recommended to learn it again in a language that they understand, because there's a lot of rules. And still we say the person is ben chorin, because the rules of the Torah free a person from other things. They free a person from the hold of forces that otherwise he might be enslaved to, whether they're forces of Yetzirah or and so on, and he would be subject to them, unable to break free of them, but now he can. And where does this come from? The same expression, chorus al haluchos, engraved on the luchos, says the Mishnah, al tikra, it's a price of it, six berakah of pirkei avos, al tikra chorus el hacheros, exactly the same drasha that the Gemara made about freedom from the nations of the world, the pirkei avos is making with regards to freedom from forces within a person. But of course we understand a person is only fully free from those forces if the words of Torah are fully engraved. The more chorus the words are, the more chayrus he has. And it's a sliding scale. It's certainly possible to be involved in Torah and still for someone to be enslaved in the forces of their drives and so on, because engagement per se is not enough. There's a reason why this is expounded from the pasuk dealing with the luchos, because if you learn Torah in the way the luchos talk about, and you take the words to heart, and you engrave them as best you can, the more you do that, the more you're free. It turns out that these two aspects of freedom, freedom from forces within, which is Pirkei Avos, and freedom from forces without, which is the Gemara and Erevin, are intimately connected. Because as far as we're concerned, when will the nations of the world ever have a hold on the Jewish people? If the Jewish people are full below the level which they should be, if the Jewish people are holding on the level that they should be, so then the nations of the world can't touch them. If the Jewish people fall, so then they now become subject to foreign forces. It turns out, therefore, that these two cheruses, these two types of liberty, are effectively two expressions of the same idea. Because the Jewish people are free from the forces of evil within, they don't have to worry about forces of evil without. But once there's a rupture there within, So then trouble could be at the doorstep or just beyond the walls. And all of this is what happened when the luchos were broken. That level was incompatible with the Jewish people. And the luchos that represent it, and again, not only represent it, but would have enabled it to happen, it couldn't happen. The Jewish people weren't luchos friendly by that stage. They weren't luchos compatible. And the luchos are broken. And moreover, it is true. Ultimately, we rehabilitated ourselves through tshuva and through the whole process, culminating in Yom Kippur. It's true. And we were even worthy of receiving luchos again, but not the same set of luchos. The second set was not the same as the first. Significantly, the difference between them is that the luchos consists of two aspects. You have the body of the luchos, the stone, and then you have the engraving, which is the writing. Who prepares the stone and who does the writing? Well, as we know, all of this is in Parshas Kisisa. With regards to the first luchos, Hashem provided everything. The body of the Luchos was prepared by Hashem. The Luchos Ma'aseh Elokim Hema. And the writing was also from Hashem. V'michtav, michtav Elokim Hu. Chorus ala Luchos. Everything came from Hashem, representing the fact that the stone is the heart, as we said. The tablets of the heart, Kasvim Aluach Libecha, that had a godly quality. Had we only kept ourselves in line until Moshe came back, we would have merited to receive that first set of Luchos, where even the heart has a much more godly enhanced quality. Then the engraving would have had the absolute effect. But those Luchos were broken. And the road back to the second Luchos doesn't get us to a repeat of the first. With the second Luchos, as we know, Hashem says to Moshe, Psal lecha, shnei Luchos avonim, you need to carve the stone. You're going to get a second set of Luchos. But Moshe, representing the Jewish people, says, Hashem, I'm not going to give you the Luchos. Which means that the heart is not God-given. It's got to be man-made. It's got to be ready. The man has to ready himself. And he can't ready himself to the same degree that Hashem could gift him. The writing will be the same. Hashem says, I'll write on this week, as the laning for Tanis Tzibur, v'chotzavti ala luchos, as advarim, asher ayu ala luchos arishonim, asher shibartom. The script will be the same, and it's Hashem who'll do the writing. V'chotzavti, Hashem says, I will write. But the luchos are prepared by man. They can't be prepared to the same degree. Which means the connection cannot be achieved to the same degree. The fusion between the words of Torah and the heart of man cannot be the same. When we say that we became compatible with Luchos again, we became fundamentally compatible with that connection. But not totally. Not completely. And that means the Jewish people are back in play. But trouble is possible. The 17th of Tammuz remains a day of calamity because what was broken was not replaced. Because what was given instead was not the same. And the ability for a weakening of the connection was much more possible. And in the fullness of time, that's what happened. And that's what led to the Churban. As if to say, the breach of the walls. On the 17th of Tammuz, the breach of the walls of the city began with a breach inside the Jewish people, within them themselves. Had they kept their own walls intact in terms of their connection with Torah, the walls of the city would have been intact. When it comes to spiritual matters, which are always the cause of physical results, fortifications are built from within. If the heart is fortified, the walls will be okay. But if there's a breach in the heart, so then trouble could be coming. And I think this gives us, without detailing it down to the letter, but it gives us, I think, a way of relating to the days of the 3 weeks, which are easy not to relate to, I think, in the sense that there's many laws and customs, but those are things that can be navigated or organized as the person somehow continues and doesn't let these things get to him. But in a sense, that might not be the best use of the 3 weeks, because if it all begins by a weakening or a loosening or a compromising of the connection between Divrei Torah and the heart, so perhaps the time, the junctures of time that we have that are made available during these 3 weeks, they would be good to be put to good use in terms of taking things to heart, the things that we do anyway, but just to absorb a little bit more, to be mindful a little bit. It's very easy for certainly nowadays for people's minds to wander, even as they're doing the right thing. But if the mind wanders, I mean, that's already a form of exile. It's already not where, well, drifting around and not where it should be. So certainly I think the more we appreciate what happened with the breaking of the Luchos and how that really was the root of everything that was to come, the more we can take steps to remedy it, because we are now in charge of the tablets of our heart. We are the ones that are meant to prepare them and to carve them and make them ready. And if the better we do, the better the connection would be, until Hashem sees fit to say to the Jewish people, I prepared their hearts enough. It's time to repair the walls. Absolutely. So these are some words with regards to the Peronios of the 17th of Tammuz. But let us come back maybe and see what this has to do with Parshas Balak, which we should not forget is the Parsha this week. The Rambam, in Hilchos Malachim, in Perek Yud Aleph, and these are the last two chapters of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, chapters number 999 and 1000 of the Mishnah Torah. And in Perek Yud Aleph and Yud Beis of Hilchos Malachim, the Rambam talks about Mashiach. And he doesn't explicate at length. He says, well, there's many things that we can't know until it happens. But he begins, of course, by talking about the whole concept of Mashiach. And the first thing the Rambam disavows us of is the notion that Mashiach is only really spoken about or alluded to in the Novi, but not so much in the Chumash. Says Rambam, that's not the case. For Rambam, of course, this is one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, Revias HaMashiach. It's got to be rooted in the Torah, and it is. Says Rambam, if you read Parshas Nitzavim, you will see the Torah foretells that Hashem will bring back the Jewish people from their exile from wherever they are. Im yenidachacha b'kteh shamayim, yisham yikabetzcha, v'shav Hashem elokecha shivuscha v'richamecha. All of those psukim about the return of the Jewish people when the time comes, the time for the final geula. So that's where it's spoken about in a very clear way. But there is another place in the Torah where the idea of Mashiach is spoken about, and actually perhaps even more so, even in more detail than those psukim in Nitzavim that we mentioned, which generally, of course, speak about Hashem bringing the Jewish people back. Says Rambam, Af b'parshas Bilam ne'emar. Even in the parsha of Bilam, the idea of Mashiach is discussed. And the Rambam proceeds to show how the last of Bilam's nevuos, and all of Bilam's nevuos have kind of like a duality to them. There's two things going on, because Bilam is talking on the one hand about the beginning of Malchus Beis David, which is David himself, and then the Mashiach. And that's why, he refers to the Psukim, this is in Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Zayin, and Pasuk Yud Ches. Bilam says, Erenu velo ata, I see him, but not now. Ata with an ayin. I see him, but not now. Ashirenu velo karov, I can see him, but it's not near. Who's not now and who's not near? Says Rambam, the first is David HaMelech. It's not now, but it will be soon. And then I see him, but he's not near because it's going to be a while until you get to Melech HaMashiach. Ashirenu v'lo karov, za Melech HaMashiach. And then you have the pasuk, Darach kochav mi Yaakov, v'kam shevet mi Yisrael. Once again, that duality. The star shoots out from Yaakov, says Rambam, that's David. The Kam Shevet Yisrael, the scepter bearer from Yisrael, that's Mashiach. Further, Machatz Pasei Moav, he shall smash the corners of Moab, that's David. Right? David waged war with Moab. And Vikarkar Kol B'nei Shes, and he will uproot all of the sons of Shes, which is the entire world, that's Mashiach. And so on and so forth. So that's what's fascinating, is aside from anything else, is that we, as we don't often do in the Mishnah Torah, we get a window into the Rambam's parshanut of these psukim. I mean, it's not easy to learn Parshas Balak. It's not easy to learn the brachos of Bilam. And here the Rambam is taking us through these psukim to understand the duality. That's David, and that's Melech HaMashiach. So this is very interesting. Because it turns out that the most detailed foretelling of Yemos HaMashiach is in Parshas Balak. Kind of interesting. And we should know that the connection between the theme of Mashiach and Parshas Balak goes further still. Because the roots of Mashiach are actually channeled through Parshas Balak. Why? Because Mashiach comes from Moav. In the sense that David is born from the union of Rus HaMoaviah and Boaz. Rus, says the Gemara in Sota and Nozir, is a descendant of Balak, king of Moab. So that's very interesting, because the roots of Mashiach are to be found with Balak, who's from Moab. Okay, becomes part of Moab. And the roots go further back, as far as Mashiach is concerned, all the way back to the beginning of Moab. Because Lot, from the outset, and Lot is the father of Moab, and from the outset, Lot is the carrier of Mashiach, of the future of Mashiach. And it's for this reason that Avram keeps Lot with him as much as he can, as far as he can, as long as possible. In fact, even Lot going together with Avram in the beginning of Lech Lecha, and Lot goes with him, it's mentioned twice in two consecutive psukim. The first pasuk says, Vayelech ito Lot, Lot went with him. And then the next pasuk says, Avram took Lot. And the reason why it's said twice is because Lot, of course, is entitled to decide whether he's coming with Avram, but Avram's going to take him anyway. There's compelling reason to keep Lot with Avram. Lot is carrying the future of the Mashiach. And Mefarshim explain, and we've mentioned this in the past, I think it's important to recognize it. How is Lot Zoche to be the progenitor of the Mashiach? We don't hear such great things from him. In fact, say the Mefarshim, the merit to be the progenitor of Mashiach that Lot had, he inherited it from his father. His father, Haran. We know that the Pasuk described, he's basically born and dies almost immediately, Pasuk-wise, as soon as he's mentioned. But what's the background to that? We know Avram was confronted by Nimrod. Is he going to stand by his faith in the one God? Is he going to capitulate and get with the program, with Nimrod's program? Avram refuses, and he's thrown into the furnace, and he emerges unscathed, miraculously. And the Medrash says, it's a well-known Medrash, that Haran is watching. He doesn't want to be the first one to make this decision. But he says, you know, see, if Avram gets burnt, that will be unfortunate, but I'll know not to follow him. But if a miracle is performed for Avram, so I'll say that I'm with Avram. And that's what happened. So Avram emerged unscathed. They then came to Haran and said, you, and what about you? And he says, I'm with Avram. And they said, are you sure? Yeah, they threw him into the furnace and he was killed. And the important point here is that we shouldn't think that this is in any way a denigration of Haran. Most people that are thrown into a furnace that's on fire do not emerge unscathed. I mean, that takes a miracle. And most people do not have miracles performed for them. Avram is an exception. In other words, we should never think, oh, Haran was an opportunist. He sat on the fence and therefore he got what was coming to him. None of that at all. Haran actually was the first person ever to offer his life al Kiddush Hashem. He didn't go in expecting a miracle would happen to him. That's not what he meant. He says, I don't know if Avram is right. If a miracle happens, I know. And if I know, I'll stake my life on it. And he did. And he gave his life for it. That's a schus. And as the first person to be Moser Nefesh for Kiddush Hashem, he's the progenitor of Mashiach. It comes through his son Lot. And Avram keeps Lot with him as long as possible. And even when him and Lot have to part ways, he doesn't really let Lot go too far. As Rashi says, he parid nami alai. I won't be far away. if you need me. And did Lot need him when the time came? I mean, the war with the four kings and the five, Lot is captured. Avram rescues him. He risks his life to rescue Lot. What's at stake is the future of the Jewish people. And interestingly, even when the city of Sodom is destroyed, Lot is saved. And who saves Lot from Sodom? The Gemara says, as we know, Avram was visited by three angels, and each one has a different task. And Raphael, as his name suggests, as the name indicates, is there to heal Avram. And Gavriel, Gevura, he is the one to overturn Sodom. Michael is the one to give Sarah the tidings that she will have a child, and thereby facilitating that whole channel of Sarah being able to give birth. Those are the three, because as we know, and that one angel can't do more than one thing, and those are the three. Three jobs for one job each. Then two of them go to Sodom because one of them saves Lot. Which one? Says the Gemara, Michael. Michael also saves Lot. And firstly, the question is, I thought we just said that one angel can't do more than one thing. And here he is, Michael, doing more than one thing. And why Michael? But the more we understand what is at stake in saving Lot, it's the future of the Jewish people. That is absolutely in line with the first shlichus of Michael. Michael is there to represent the interests of the Jewish people. He's called Sar Yisrael, Michael Sar Yisrael. And it's for that reason that he was the one that was chosen to give Sarah the tidings that she will have a child. That's the beginnings of the Jewish people. And in keeping with that shlichus, he also then goes to save Lot, because Lot is the end of the Jewish people. It's something that they'll need later on. Mashiach is a Jewish concern, just as Yitzchak is, and the same angel does both. And Lot carries these the future of Mashiach with him until he then has his sons with his two daughters. One is Ammon, one's Moab. Interestingly, from that point on, we never hear from Lot again. Everything that Lot had going for him has already been passed on to his son / grandson Moab. So Lot, there's not much to say about Lot anymore. And actually the Torah doesn't say anything about him. And Avram doesn't communicate with him again. But for his time, he was carrying Mashiach. Now it's been passed on. And it goes down into Moab. And now Balak is the king of Moab. And he then becomes a part of the chain of that which will lead to the Mashiach himself. So it's very interesting. Parshas Balak is generally read just before the 3 weeks. And the themes of Mashiach are highlighted just before we enter the 3 weeks. That is the concept of Makdim Refuah Lamakah. We always find that there is an expression of the cure before the problem, because the goal of the problem is to bring the cure about. It's necessary, but that's the goal. The goal is never the Makkah for itself. Even the Churban, even the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, its goal is never itself. The goal of the Churban is in order to bring about a rectification of that which went wrong. And the way that that's emphasized is that the rectification is expressed before the problem even comes. This is what it's about. But now we need to know how to get there. And so we discuss people who will be the roots of the final Geula. It's still very much in the primordial stages. It's still Balak, but he's now carrying the future of the Jewish people, which will come in through Rus. We read about the concept of the Mashiach in the Brachos of Bilam. All of that is happening in Parshas Balak. And there is a further theme. At what point does Moab entered the Jewish people. It's when Ruth enters the Jewish people. And she then marries Boaz. And their son is Obed. Obed's son is Yishai. Yishai's son is David. When did this happen? Can we know? So there is a fascinating section in the drushes of the Chasam Sofer. And the Chasam Sofer says, yeah, we can know. What do we know about Rus? The chapter one of Megillas Rus, so they leave, there's a time of famine, and everything goes wrong there in Eretz Moab, and the only two really that remain are Rus and Naomi. And the Pasuk says that they returned b'tchilat kitzir sasa'orim, the beginning of the barley harvest. When is that? Says the Targum to Rus, that was the middle of Nisan. I mean, we know the middle of Nisan is that's when the beginning of the barley harvest. The Omer is from barley, and that's on the second day of Pesach. So it's the middle of Nisan. That's when the barley harvest begins. And then Rus, she goes to this field, to that field. She finds Boaz's field, and Boaz says, "Stay with this field," and she does. For how long? For 3 months. So she's collecting gleanings in the field of Boaz for 3 months. That takes us from the middle of Nisan to Iyar Sivan Tammuz. That means those 3 months were up around the middle of Tammuz. At that point, Naomi says action needs to be taken. And as we know, chapter 3, Megillas Rus, Naomi says to Rus, you got to go to Boaz and tell him to start to take care of things, which she does. She goes to Boaz that night. That night is the night of the evening of the 16th of Tammuz. And Boaz says, I'll take care of it tomorrow, which he does. And they get married the next day, which is the 16th of Tammuz. And then their child is conceived. When? On the evening before the 17th of Tammuz. And from that union comes the roots of Mashiach. So the concept of Makdim Refuah Lamaka is not only in terms of reading about these things, but actually the entry of Moab, of Mashiach being carried by through Moab with Rus and Boaz. And that union, which then led to the conception of Oved, the grandfather of David HaMelech, that took place on Shivas HaBetamos, on the night of Shivas HaBetamos. And that's Makdim Refuah Lamaka. Once again, the 3 weeks begin already with that being prepared. And what does this mean? It means that the days ahead, which they have their challenges. I think it's fair to say that we've been aware of these challenges. It hasn't taken the 3 weeks for us to realize that things are seriously wrong in terms of our situation, both in Eretz Yisrael and in Chutz La'aretz. We're still in the middle of Galus, which means that when the days of the 3 weeks come, so that they're there to be used. They're there to be engaged with. And the goal will always be to bring about a positive outcome. It's not the focus of the days. The focus of the days is Avelus over the Churban. It's recognizing the loss. That's the focus. Focus and goal are not always the same thing. The goal of all of that is to bring the Geula. But we can't rectify something if we haven't confronted just how badly it is in disrepair. So these are days that they're not normal days for us. When we think about how we normally go about our Jewish lives, it doesn't have such aspects of mourning over the Churban and exile and so on. But they're there to be used. And moreover, they're the crucial first step for everything else that we'd like to come about. We have the amazing nevuah of Zechariah. Zechariah talks about all of these fast days. And there's four fast days throughout the course of the year that are related to the Churban, leaving aside Yom Kippur, leaving aside Tanis Esther. But you have Tzom HaRevi, the fast of the fourth month, again counting from Nisan, that's Tammuz, Shivasa B'Tammuz. Tzom HaChemishi, the fifth month, that's Tisha B'Av. Tzom HaShvi, the seventh month, that's Tishrei, Tzom Gedalia. For Tzom HaAsiri, the tenth month, Teves, Asara B'Teves. All of those, says the Navi Zechariah, will become for the Jewish people days of festivals. Lemadim Tovim. And now you kind of feel like you've heard everything. These days in the future will be festivals. And we try and approach it balabatishly. Why will these days become festivals? As if to say, currently they're days of mourning. If the mourning stops, so then they just become normal days. Hopefully, that's a good outcome. And the Navi says, no, they will not become normal days. They will never be normal days. They'll become Yomim Tovim. And interestingly, as Reb Leib Mintzberg points out, all of these days of mourning, we say they'll become Yomim Tovim, they were meant to be Yomim Tovim from the outset. Imagine for a moment had we not made the Egel. What would the first 17th of Tammuz have looked like? It would have been a festival. We would have received the first set of luchos. What a joyous occasion. It's meant to be a joyous day. It got hijacked by the Egel until further notice. It's an amazing perspective. Because when we say that the 17th of Tammuz in the future will be a festival, it's the festival that it should have been, always. It's a full revolution. And the same is true for Tisha B'Av. Imagine the miraculum had not happened. That is to say, had they not gone wrong. So what would the miraculum have looked like if it went right? They would have come back and said, the land is wonderful, let's go. And that would have enshrined the day as a Yom Tov. This is would have been remembered every year since. This is the day the miraculum came back with encouraging news. And here we are. So all these days are, their imprimatur from the outset is meant to be positive, but they got derailed, so they just need to be reinstated. But how does one go from mourning, from a day of mourning, that is to say, to a festival? I mean, maybe just leave it alone. But the more we understand how engaging in these days with mindfulness, that itself is the process that turns them into festivals. Where does the Geula come from? It comes from these days. As long as we don't use the days to recognize what it is that we've lost, it's hard to see how we're able to get it back. So using the days as days of Avelus is itself, and it's such a Jewish idea, but it's in itself brings the Geula, and as an accessory to the Geula, we won't forget about these days in the future. These will be celebrated as Yom Tov. These are building days. I remember the stunning comment of the Shalom HaKadosh, just to give us an idea, because as Jews, I mean, we might be naturally pessimistic, I mean, unless we are really in a difficult situation. But we're not sure what to make of this Avelus. But as we say, it's what you could call constructive mourning. We need to recognize it in order to get out of it. But that's the goal, is to get out of it. The way the Shalom HaKadosh says, we know that there's no mourning for the Beis HaMikdash on Shabbos. Even if Tisha B'Av itself falls on Shabbos, which it can, as we know, it's pushed off. And Shabbos is a... We don't forget about it, but we don't have the Avelus on Shabbos, but why not? Says the Shalom HaKadosh. Because when you mourn for the Beis HaMikdash, you are contributing to the construction of the future Beis HaMikdash. Every building starts by digging a hole. You lay foundations. The foundations of the future Beis HaMikdash is the Avelus on the previous Churban. But you're not allowed to dig foundations on Shabbos. It's usur. It's called bona. Says the Shalah, if we understand the constructive role of Avelus, you can't do it on Shabbos. You can't build on Shabbos. That's what Avelus is. That's what mourning for the Beis HaMikdash is. It's constructing the foundations for the next. Okay, that's a problem on Shabbos. It's called the Malacha of Bona. So this is the Torah alchemy of taking a day of mourning and turning it into a festival. But as the Arizal comments, on the 16th of Tammuz, when Aaron, they've made the egel, and Aaron just wants to put a stop to it, he sends everyone home and he says, Chag Lashem Machar, tomorrow this will be a festival to Hashem. Says Arizal, the word Machar can mean a number of things. It can either mean tomorrow, literally, the day after today, or it could mean in the future, tomorrow. And in the end, both were true. Had the Jewish people kept themselves together, it would have been a festival for Hashem the very next day. But as we know, what happened, and it was the Egel. We've taken a circuitous route, but the truth remains. Aaron says, tomorrow it will be a Chag Lashem. It will take a while before it becomes a Chag Lashem, because the Jewish people have necessitated a longer and more arduous route. But in the end, Chag Lashem Achar. What the Novi Zachariah says, these days of mourning will be turned into festivals. Aaron has already said it. In the end, it will be a festival. Chag Lashem Machar. It might not be Bachar on the meter between today and tomorrow, but it will happen. And the Jewish peoples are the ones that will make it happen. And that's through giving us some connection with the days that are headed. And in Mitzvah Hashem, we hope that if we still need them, these should be the last set of the 3 weeks. But if we have them, we have them to use them, and we should play our role in so doing of converting them from days of mourning to days of festivals. Should only have Besoros Tovos, Yeshuas, V'Nechamos, Bekarov. All the best.